Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative medicine practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. This is the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm Andrew Whitfield Cook. Today we're speaking with Geraldine Headley, a longtime friend of mine, and who has great experience in mentoring naturopaths in their professional life. Welcome to Natural Medicine Podcast, Geraldine. How are you going?
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Andrew. I'm going really well. I'm still seeing clients. I'm a naturopath and a herbalist and a nutritionist and all of the things that I see the clients, but I love my mentoring. And that is where I've been putting my focus more and more recently, as you said. So it's been ages since we met and lots of changes. I'm loving the new podcast.
It's great. Yeah, new evolution. Wheels turn, don't they? Now, you left out one of your expertises, if that's a word, and that is gin making.
Oh, well,
Show us.
I've just got to put it away. So what happened is I bought a bottle of gin and it was pretty flavorless, right? So being the herbalist that I am, I had some juniper berries and a few other botanicals. And so I popped them in the bottle and put the top on. And I just showed it to Andrew before. And the thing is, that's called a bathtub gin. That's how gin was originally made. So they'd put the alcohol in a bath, they add the botanicals and they'd stir it. So it means you don't have a crystal clear gin, but you will have a flavorsome gin. But it does mean obviously the alcohol content will vary. This one won't because it's somebody's pre-made gin. Wasn't very nice. So I've made it nicer. The herbalist in me popped out on that gin and made it nicer by adding more juniper berries.
I think it's awesome. And it, you know what? It speaks volumes of the expertise that we have that's untapped, because we're now seeing boutique gins popping up everywhere.
Yep.
It's making this real renaissance. Yep. And some of them are actually quite tasty. Oh, hell, I'm going to spruik somebody's. So Four Pillars. I love the aniseed.
Yeah,
but and I've tasted a couple of local gins, like one down towards just behind Byron. The thing that I love about it is that it's made with Davidson's plum.
Oh, yum!
And so it's very sweet. It's not something that you can drink a lot of, which is probably a good thing. But boy, is it! Oh, it's lovely. You don't care to mix it. It's just lovely.
There's a local fig gin here and they're more of an aperitif. So when you get these highly flavored gins, it's a good idea just to have them with ice. You just put ice in them and drink it as an aperitif slowly. Don't add the tonic because the tonic has got so much flavor. And so that's the last thing you'd add. If you wanted to thin it with anything, you'd put a tiny bit of soda water in. But the best way of doing it is to add ice. Ice will slowly infuse into it. And you've got this beautiful aromatic botanical blend. Can I give you a little trick about a lot of these gins? The gins that are winning all these awards, not all of them, but a lot of the gins that are winning awards are using a grape skin ethanol from here in South Australia. So they use the Tarac Technologies grape skin ethanol. So when you go for the tastings and you say, because if they've got their own distillery and they're actually distilling it, then they're making their own alcohol base. But a lot of them aren't. A lot of them are doing what a bathtub style, except it's not. It's not made in a bathtub. It's made in a barrel and it's all done professionally. Yeah. But they do get their alcohol from someone else, their base alcohol.
Yeah.
And generally it's coming from the grape skins in South Australia from this company called Tarac. And as a herbalist, we can buy that alcohol. So I do have some brewing of my own at the moment. I wasn't actually going to admit to that, but I do have, as well as that one that I, had to make taste nice, I've actually got one on the go in the other room of using my ethanol and spring water and the botanicals that I've chosen to put in there. So, I've got
to
teach you.
I think it's probably drawing a long bow to say that it's a herbal medicine, but perhaps it has some therapeutic activity. But it, in a weird and rather tenuous way, it has a very weak link into what we're going to be discussing today. And that is, and that is the dangerous line between what we disparagingly call big pharma. But the question is, do we sometimes fall into being big nature? And this is something that has concerned me for a while. And that is, we are very quickly turning towards quite complex systems, if you like, and in a way trying to be little doctors with a leaf waving attached sort of thing. My fear is that we're losing our touch, our roots with the old ways. And I see that as a big danger. What's your thoughts on this?
I do think we're losing it, but I also think we're being led down the garden path at all sides. Doctors, nurses, naturopaths, nutritionists, we're all being led down the garden path. There's all PR, there's advertising, there's everyone's using, you know, NLP techniques. It's all, there's a lot in the mix that you don't realize. So I'm sitting here at the moment, I've got a pad next to me and it's got a company brand on the top. It's beautiful quality paper, so I'm going to use it. But it does mean I'm reminded of that brand all the time. And so I have to remember not to be swayed by this notepad that I'm using and by my pens aren't, but a lot of them in my pen pot are branded. And so we have to remember that these sway us to things and we mustn't be swayed by, I mean, I love this particular size of notepaper. I find it very useful. And so I actually go around and I take them off all the companies if they happen to have an A5 size pad. So I've got hundreds from all the different companies. But I have to be careful not to be swayed by that. I have to be careful that when I go to a seminar, that, and seminars are product-based. A company is selling you a product. That's why they're there. That's why some people have got them for free because they sell lots of their product. But it might be, in my case, I sell only through distributors. So the companies don't necessarily know how much of their product I'm selling. So I'm going, I have to pay for my ticket to be there. Generally, it includes dinner. And then there's learning. But then there's also, hey, look, our product just happens to fit into our spiel. And I was at a conference, an independent conference, I don't know how many years ago, because I don't know if we should count 2020 or not. We could just slice that off the calendar. Sorry, I can't remember what year it was, but I went to the Australian Naturopathic Summit and Jason Hallerat got up and spoke, and he pointed out he'd been to one of these seminars. And in the seminar, of course, they like to put in all the evidence at the back, you know, for using their product. But what he pointed out with this evidence was you wouldn't get away with that in university. It was, a lot of it was more than 10 years old, but it wasn't traditional evidence. So it was no good. It was old papers that had been superseded by new and updated information. And the company had selectively taken lines out of papers that didn't support the product. So in actual fact, we're going along.
We've seen, I see what you mean. Omitting the negative. Right.
Yeah. Omitting the negatives, not adding the information that we needed to truly evaluate the products that they were spruiking. And because you see this long list of, you know, journal articles and research, you think, wow, look at this product. But many of them weren't, as he pointed out and as he highlighted in his talk, they weren't actually related. He didn't name and shame. So, you know, it was just a case of do your research. It's great going to these things. I always say, do not buy when you're there, because you're almost under the influence. You know, it's like, you know, they hyped it up, they're standing there, it's all rah rah rah, and then they're like, buy X number, here's your form, hand it to us as you walk out the door. And you're more likely to tick for more of them, whereas you might not actually get those clients in your clinic for a while. What are you going to do? Are you going to start giving it to the wrong person, the person who might vaguely need it, because you've got to get it off your shelves? You know?
There's a lot of issues with pecuniary interests, isn't there? One of the things you said earlier, with companies providing you with stationery, for instance, this has been a massive issue in the medical industries to the point where now that's forbidden. But I do note that it was not too long ago, and indeed it was after this time, where companies were allegedly forbidden for having branded things. But instead what they would give is non-branded things, but they would still give things. Like, for instance,
keyboards for computers. Mm-hmm. Now, I remember one doctor attending that said that another doctor walked out of there with five keyboards. Right. How many computers do you have? Like, are you just, you know, redoing your office? But the drug companies have so much money that they're able to provide these things. Of course, they're non-branded, so they're okay. I also remember many, many years ago, I don't know if this has changed now, but I remember a drug rep, forgive me, having a budget of, you know, at least $10,000 per year. $10,000. And so what he chose was to make Easter eggs in the shape of a certain organ, which he specialized in. Now, I won't go into it. I'll keep it generic. But it reeks of how much money these drug companies have.
Yeah.
We, however, as you say, when you say you've got to be very mindful not to use their stuff, there is always that unconscious thing about that's nice paper, what you said.
Yeah.
And you get beautiful. A pen with a nice feel. So there is this unconscious pecuniary interest, which sort of is very insidious in working its way into your practice.
Although you did say the keyboards that they got were unbranded, you're sitting at that keyboard all day, every day. So it might not have a brand on it, but I'm sitting here, I use Mac, so I've got a Mac keyboard in front of me. Yep. Now, I know there's better keyboards than this one, ones with numbers on the side and all the rest of it, but I've got a Mac keyboard. I'm not in denial about that. If somebody gave me a keyboard, every time I used it, if I liked the touch or the feel or whatever it was, I'd be going, oh, thank you so much, whoever you are. Mm. You know, and I would look at it and it's still selling to me. I'm still getting something.
Absolutely.
Whether it's you got the brand or not.
You will remember that feeling, not so much the product. You
I got to take five away from it. Exactly, I got five of them. Everyone in my office has got them from this company. You know, look, we're all the same. We got them from blah, blah company.
So
you're going to remember.
So let's delve into this big pharma, big nature thing and how we fall into wanting to be a natural doctor, if you like.
Yeah.
A doctor with a leaf waving attached. I see a danger there on a couple of levels. And one of them is the level of education that naturopaths receive is not, you can make a naturopathic diagnosis just like you and I can make a nursing diagnosis, but that's not a medical diagnosis.
Yep.
So where do you sit with regards to having a patient come to you with a nondescript thing? Do you actually go down that illegal avenue of trying to make a quasi-medical diagnosis? Or should we really rest on the rich history of natural medicine and make a natural medicine diagnosis, a naturopathic diagnosis, which isn't necessarily tied into, you know, something like thalassemia or rheumatoid arthritis or Alzheimer's? That's a medical diagnosis, but we can make a naturopathic diagnosis that's a lot more blurry, a lot more forgiving, I might add.
Absolutely. And when we make that naturopathic diagnosis, when we look at that client, generally in my practice, people come in with, I've been to the doctor and I've had all these things done. This is what the doctor said. These are the drugs that I'm on. So I kind of know the diagnosis anyway. So I've pretty much got it there. Every so often they'll come in and they'll say, I'm scared of the doctors and I won't go. And so I have to do all of the, you know, the physical examination things and check them out. And on one occasion I said, I have to stop seeing you right now because your blood pressure is 240 on 180 and I'm actually going to call an ambulance, you know? And he was like, oh no, you can't do that. I haven't got ambulance insurance. And I was like, you're not staying in my room. This, you know, we have to move. This is medical. I need you to leave now. I need to get you there. And who can I call that will take you? So, you know, there are the people who won't go and see a doctor, unfortunately, because there are hundreds of thousands of brilliant doctors in the world, you know, and everything I do complements what they do. And I hope that what they do complements what I do. But we're all influenced by things. We all want the best for our patient. And so, I call them a client. So, because they're paying me directly. So I want the best for my clients. So if I make a naturopathic diagnosis on them, it's with the use of the medical diagnosis that I have, with the use of the blood tests, scans, whatever it is they've had, because often I'm working to that medical diagnosis, but they're here for their symptoms. They're here not for a cure. We can't cure anything. No one will say they've cured anything. A doctor won't say they've cured anything. You might be in remission, but nobody's going to say they've cured anything because the next thing's just about to come along because you're getting older. So when we think about it, we think about this bigger picture. And within that bigger picture, we have a huge amount of resources, starting with the diet. And I've got almost an hour with my client at the first, 55 minutes is what I give for the first appointment, and then 40 minutes for follow-ups. So I have a lot longer with my clients than a doctor has. They've got 15 minutes, 20 minutes
max.
Tops.
Max.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I've got a lot longer to be able to work on their base health. And if I'm not bringing in Mother Nature into my prescription, and that is diet and lifestyle habits, all of those things into my prescription, then I'm not doing my job. Whereas when we go to a doctor with our symptom, we're expecting a pill.
Mm.
We're expecting a result. And people go to the doctor and they get angry when they don't get antibiotics. And the doctor's saying, but you've got a cold, it's viral. I can't give you antibiotics for that. And they're like, no, I want antibiotics. And so often they will crumble because they're overwhelmed as well. They're stressed by it. So they're like, okay, here's your prescription, but please don't take it, you know, because they're pressured all the time too. So the pressures come from all sides, and the diagnosis will come from the medical side, from you, or from your client. Remember, the client will come in self-diagnosed with something.
Yeah. How often does that happen these days? So can I ask you about that big nature attraction? You know, very often this is hidden as a teaching or a learning event. And we've learned some very complex things. And I should admit that natural medicine practitioners have to learn two forms of medicine. Mm. They have to learn the one that they're espousing. They also have to learn medicine, because you need to know what's safe and what's not safe to have alongside it. Whereas an orthodox practitioner does not have to learn anything about natural medicine. They really just have to look at what side effects are espoused, you know, because some book says so, even though the actual evidence on that interaction might be rather shaky at best. For instance, CoQ10 with warfarin. And despite the TGA warnings that we are mandated to have on supplements, the actual evidence is a bit shaky. It sort of goes either way, you know. Yeah. So are we losing the old benefits of these therapies and moving on to a new way of using them that is perhaps more restrictive?
We've also got to think about that, the way the company wants to sell us something. So there's always this thing, oh, you can't patent herbs. And so big pharma just want to patent our herbs, so we haven't got them. They do want to take out certain parts, and aspirin did come from, you know, Fermetasweet and all of those things, willow bark. And that is totally cool, because they've taken it and they've produced a product, and they've taken a lot of science to do it and a lot of activity and a lot of people and all the rest of it, and they've produced something. We're producing something, and we can't knock the other guys, because we're all doing what we can within our remit, but we have to look outside the square, just like everybody in all of this needs to look outside the square at the qualified people, because that's one of the biggest issues. Is you could Google curcumin, and you will get 300, you know, on my computer when I know we're saying Google, as that is the browser I use, but I mean, you could be on any browser. Whichever browser that you use will give you, it changes depending where you live. So I will get, my computer is used to coming up with academic papers. So that's what I'm more likely to get on my laptop. So, but if I take my laptop from Adelaide, which is quite conservative in Adelaide, and I went to Byron Bay, for example, my laptop would start giving me different results because the local community gives you different results.
Because of the algorithms, you mean?
Algorithm changes per place, per population base. So what I will be seeing for curcumin, if I'm in Brisbane or Byron Bay or somewhere along the coast, is going to be different to what I will see in Adelaide or in Perth or perhaps in New Zealand or America. All right, which is weird, isn't it? I just discovered this randomly. But then that affects how we treat people and what we think of supplements. So here in Australia, we have a medical system that doesn't include any natural medicines. But for example, in South Africa, they're all trained together initially and then they branch out.
Yeah.
All right. So all your physiotherapists, nurses, homeopaths, doctors, everybody starts out in that first 4 years together. So they're going to have a different attitude when they qualify to those of us who all do everything separately, because they're going to know each other.
Yeah.
They're going to understand the base. So they've learned all those things together. So depending which country you're in will also depend how you behave. Where you are locally will be your answer. This is, you know, curcumin. Oh, it's rubbish. I've had, you know, people say it's absolute rubbish. It's nonsense. But actually there's a Cochrane review on it, guys. You know, so there's places to look where we can find this information that we can all share.
Yeah.
And we have to remember that whether you're a doctor or a nurse or a naturopath or a nutritionist, doesn't matter what you are the person who wants to help others. You are totally the person who wants to help. You've got empathy. Every doctor has empathy. They're just overwhelmed and worn out. They have empathy. They have love for their patient. They want to be in the profession for the person, just like we do. But we're all influenced by what's going on around us. And we're all influenced by what we see on our computer, on our TV, and by these people who give us things, whether that be natural medicine or big pharma or big nature or big pharma.
Mm. Yeah.
You know.
I've got a counter with just one comment mm-hmm. you made about the doctors in Australia aren't herbalists sort of thing. I would counter that they actually are. Forgive me. And it's my argument against those orthodox practitioners that say mm-hmm. that herbal medicine doesn't work. And that is that orthodox medical practitioners in Australia, very often, particularly of the older ilk, they actually are herbalists. They just don't know it, because how many times have they actually prescribed a product called Senacot, which is Senna as standardized to senicides.
Yeah.
So that is a standardized herbal medicine, nothing more, nothing less. It is herbal medicine. So it's just a little bit of a glib sort of answer that I have for those people that say that herbal medicine doesn't work. The other one, of course, is, you know, remotive for depression and anxiety. You're not allowed to say or claim depression, but its use is in depression. The evidence is in depression. And the other one is, of course, iberogast. Now, if anybody who says herbal medicine doesn't work, why did a massive pharmaceutical purchase it? Purchase the
thing is, gastroenterologists, they're telling their clients to have it. They're saying have iberogast.
That's right.
So, but what I've found with the doctors that I know, and I, like you, you know, background in nursing, so we know a lot of medical people, they're interested in the herbs because they see it as a medicine. They see it as, like, you know, you're taking an aspirin. Well, we've got, you know, we've got the meadowsweet, we've got the willow bark, we've got the original, the base product. And so they see it as medicine. And so mostly the doctors and nurses that I meet are all, oh, herbal medicine, how interesting. I give herbs to my doctor friends. But if I was to say, oh, you should have vitamin C for that, not vitamin C, something, vitamin E, I don't know, something, a B vitamin perhaps, they go, oh, what's the evidence? So the nutraceutical side for them is like, and show me that evidence. Whereas the traditional side, the herbal side, they can see that there is a past with these things, and that you can't, you know, with traditional medicine and with the use of medicines, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Mm. So understanding evidence-based medicine means understanding the use of traditional medicines, and those traditional medicines, in my case, I'm a brown bottle herbalist. I'm really not very good at growing anything. Mm. I might blame South Australia for that. The weather, you know, it's just too hot. Can't grow anything. But maybe it's me. Other people seem to manage. But we have to remember that evidence-based medicine means finding the evidence and tradition. So it has to be, what is it, over 100 years old to be to have a tradition. And within that tradition, like you mentioned Grieve before, there is the tradition there. And when we look at these books and the drawings, you know, Korean ginseng is a great one, isn't it? You see the root and it's like the little man, you know. So we've got all these things. And yet walnuts, really good for the brain. And what do they look like? Little brains. Because, you know, they're a nut and they're full of all these nutrients and oils that the brain needs. So when we're talking about what we do as healthcare professionals as a whole, we all want the same thing. But we're all being influenced by big nature and big pharma. And we've got to really think about how can I make sure that it's actually my client. I can't be part of multi-level marketing for that exact reason, because with multi-level marketing, that company wants me to sell that brand to that client and that product to that client. So that's against APRA registration to be part of a multi-level marketing network where you're branding and selling that product. The NHAA, it's part of the code of ethics that we're not part and we're not selling from a multi-level marketing company. Now, you could think to yourself that some of the brands we use pretty much almost multi-level marketers. There's, you know, you get extra, you'll get, you get to go to dinner. So it's the same with Big Pharma. Everybody's working almost on this multi-level marketing system. So we have to think about how can we change that within our business, because all change starts with one. All change starts with one person, with one life, you know. What's that girl who's the 16-year-old who's going around about climate change? She's one person, but look at the amount of people she's mobilized.
Yeah.
And if we as one person in our practice say, yes, I've got that labeled notepad that I'm using, but I've been through their products. I actually only like three or four of them. And this company over here whose pad I haven't got, do comparable ones. Which one is going to be more benefit to my client in the situation they are in, that is going to not interact with the medications they're on, that isn't going to upset their tummy or whatever, and is going to be best for them. And that isn't going to be something from a multi-level marketing company, because then I only have one choice.
Yeah. This is something that I really do espouse. And that is, like, I have the utmost respect for those practitioners that have gotten off their own bat and made their own labels for their herbal medicines. They're not by a commercial supplier. They're their own branding. They've got their own pads. They've got their own, call it marketing material if you like, but their own branded materials, just like dentists have their own pens, you know, things like that.
I've got, for the video, for anyone watching the video, I've got my name up behind me with my logo on it.
Yeah.
So this for me is a branded piece of commentary, because my brand is there and it's saying who I am all the time.
Yeah. So I guess the lesson is, you know, we have to really give accolades and acknowledgement to any traditional form of medicine. And we must give it the respect that it deserves, whilst embracing and moving forward with the science that we learn about, you know, newer concepts, for instance, but also newer ways of learning of using old medicines. Yeah. I take your point as well, by the way, Geraldine, and that is, you're talking about how you'd take your computer from one place to another. And it reminded me of how media paints natural medicine in a negative light very often. And I was speaking to, and forgive me, I've slipped, I cannot remember your name at the moment, but she's a doctor working at Griffith University on the Gold Coast, and she specialises in this, how media is manipulated by, for instance, certain factions and what interference these factions have on manipulating the narrative of media. For instance, on any one given day, let's say there's two side effects, one's from a herbal medicine, one's from a drug. You will definitely hear that night on the evening news, the one to do with the herbal medicine. But I'll bet your bottom dollar you won't hear, unless it's catastrophic, you won't hear anything about that medicine. And that's got to do with how the narrative is manipulated in the media. So for any orthodox medical practitioners out there who start to believe this, you really have to look further than what you see on the news. I would urge you to look at the database of adverse event notification, the DAEN, provided by the TGA, and then you can look at the actual truth behind how often and how severe these actual events are when they're reported.
That actually made me think about that. It's often spruiked. There, you know, this person went to the shelves and took 40 products off the shelves and tested them, and they weren't what they said they were in the can. Now, that person had to fly from Australia to America to do that because our products here are the best in the world, and they are what they say they are on the can. And that is really, really important to know, that we are different in Australia to the rest of the world. You cannot sell anything unless it has an Austell number on the front. You know, some companies will put things through as food rather than go to get the Austell. Why are they doing that? Because they're not guaranteeing, they're not checking. They will market it as a food. But we need to know these things as well. And a great example I've got of that is, I was a very long time ago, it was in the days when it was harder to get a lot of gut health information, because I do a lot of gut health in my practice, a lot of IBS and IBD. And so this is 12, 13 years ago. And I was, you know, doing a search, and I found a Cochrane review, and I was looking at a Cochrane review for this woman's gut problem. And I went through and I read the Cochrane review, and right at the bottom, it said that lactobacillus, lactobacillus, that is not the right thing that I just said there. Lactobacillus, I can't remember which one it was. Anyway, one of the ones was found to be 40% effective in this client base, right? And I said this to my husband. I was like, oh, wow, 40% effective. But then the author has gone on to say, so that's no good. They might as well drink one of these calcium drinks, not wanting to name any brands. It actually mentioned a brand. So I should say the brand Pepto-Bismol. You might as well use Pepto-Bismol because that gives the same efficacy. So 40%. And I said 40%. He said, if a drug company had 40% for their drug, you would see that all over the TV.
Yeah.
That would be in neon sign. You'd see it in the square, in Times Square in New York, saying that their drug had a 40%.
That's got to do with the number needed to treat, right?
Yeah. So here was this Cochrane review, but because, I mean, Cochrane reviews are by people. So the author was like, well, you know, 40%, who cares? Whereas 40%, we know so much more now about probiotics than we did then. So that was his opinion at the end. But we know now that all these probiotics, they have a totally different effect. Lots more happens now that we didn't know then. But what I'm commenting on is, he made that comment at the bottom that might make people go, oh, wow. You know,
to me, that smacks of ignorance about what he's actually researching.
Totally.
Forgive me, but how often have we seen people talking about, you know, using 400 international units of vitamin D and then saying it's got a negative outcome? Whereas you get experts who really know what they're talking about, like Professor Michael Hollick, the god of vitamin D, and he'll espouse that we should be taking between 3,000 and 5,000 units, and that should be tripled or quintupled, depending on if you're obese or if you're using certain medications like steroids, which actually break down vitamin D. So there's no, the people who are not experts are just saying, the people who are experts in this really know what are the effectors of therapeutic dose and how you're going to gain a therapeutic outcome from it, and tying that in with safety. I remember Michael Hollick saying, you know, rather than testing vitamin D, because we're wasting millions of dollars. Indeed, I think it was $114 million Australia wasted on stupid vitamin D tests. Whereas we could give 3,000 to 5,000 units of vitamin D at a fraction of the cost, and it's so safe because it's known that nothing under 10,000 will cause an issue in most people. So it's just, anyway, we're getting off track about dosage here.
We are getting off track. But we all have to remember that everybody's auntie and everybody's uncle is now an expert. And that's what we're seeing. You know, there's lots of fake news out there. There is so much fake news out there, and it's hard to get to the bottom of it. There's some fake news around at the moment that one of the journals apparently said this, that, and the other thing. But if you go back to the journal is putting out there, we didn't say that. That wasn't us. It's a fake piece. So we really have to be going back and looking at, so right back to the beginning of this conversation was when I was saying, you know, this Dr. Jason Hollerach had gone through and looked at those references, and he'd gone and checked them. And that's what we have to do. We have to be checking our references back at source.
Yeah.
We have to be looking for the updated information, and we have to be sharing information in a way that encourages others to want that information, so that we're not pressured by Big Pharma and Big Nature to do what they want us to do, but instead we do what our clients need us
and,
to do.
And what, one of the things that goes with that is to be more open to criticism, to be more open to be wrong. For instance, I've seen experts make a stance on certain things, and yet, you know, not 2 weeks later, evidence to the contrary came out, and it was kind of like, you know, but people tend to make emotional decisions. We all do it. Everybody does it, regardless of what we'd like to think. But with regards to Big Pharma, Big Nature, I think the big lesson is to keep questioning. And to, I actually see a therapeutic action for self-doubt. And I'd like to say that word rather than reassessment, because reassessment is just like, oh, you're doing good anyway. Whereas self-doubt hopefully teaches you to be humble in the face of your patient's health, to actually doubt what your therapeutic actions or therapeutic decisions are. So that you make sure that you're being an advocate for your patient's health. I think that's the big sort of lesson that I wanted to get across there.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got to be advocates every step of the way for our clients, no matter who you are and what you do. If you're in any form of caring space, we are the advocate for that person in front of us, and we have to do the best by them. So we have to be mindful of who's pressuring us, who's sending us information, and of the latest research and the changes that can be out there, and checking our sources and checking what's going on.
Geraldine Headley, thanks so much for taking us through this bit of a quagmire. Few little segues there, but thanks so much for taking us through the relevant information regarding Big Pharma versus Big Nature.
Thank you so much for having me, Andrew. And yes, we did go off piste a little bit, but it was great to be here.
It's always great chatting with you, Geraldine. And of course, we'll have all the other podcasts and the show notes up on the Natural Medicine Partners website. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Andrew Whitfield Cook.